Okay, so pay attention, everybody. Do you know about carbon offsetting? Be honest now, not many hands up. So if you don't know about carbon offsetting, fear not, all will be revealed. But what did you say to me the other day?
I'll be honest with you, I didn't know that much about carbon offsetting.
I didn't see your hand up.
No, I mean, it would have been half up. Because obviously I knew something and people all know a little bit about it. But boy, did I learn how holistic we should be thinking when it comes to purchasing carbon credits. I love this deeply scientific exploration.
After we got off carbon offsetting, we went on to carbon insetting.
We did. It was so, so enriching to learn about this. Did need a bit of a lie down afterwards, rest your old grey matter.
Well, but it was fascinating. It comes all the way from New Zealand.
And, yes.
And I think I mentioned last week, I've got experience of the North Island in New Zealand. Lovely place. Lots of cows in North Island.
John Stullen is the Director of Business Development at Innovatech in New Zealand, and Sean Weaver, founder and CEO of ECOS, which is an environmental financing consulting business focusing on indigenous forest carbon products.
So it's Sean Weaver and John Stullen in the hot seat today. First of all, we hear from John Stullen.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Well, I'm an engineer who's been running the conference business in the forest products industry in New Zealand, Australia and Canada for the last 23 years. Our conferences are mainly focused on forest technology and how it's changed the industry. And we have really strong support from the foresters and people in the sawmills. And we also have been doing tall timber building for the last 5 years. So we go right across the sector and we have really strong following in New Zealand and Australia, and we've been operating in Canada for the last 5 years. And carbon forestry is one of the key events that is showing how the industry is changing.
It certainly is changing, and we're going to hear more about the conference later. And Sean, tell us a little bit about you as well, please.
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. I'm essentially a forest conservation junkie who needs to find ways to finance his habit. And carbon financing is one way to do that. And we'll discuss later on why that's the case. But fundamentally, forest conservation costs money. And if you have a dream for forest conservation, that's one thing. But if you can't finance your dream, then dreaming is all you get to do. So financing that forest conservation is key. Different parts of that include things like forest establishment costs, forest management costs, but a key part of the financing puzzle is the opportunity cost, which is what is that landowner giving up in order to do conservation? And if they're a landowner in, say, a developing country, a rainforest country, where they're very poor and they live in on the edge of a forest and they own that forest, if you want to do forest conservation, then they're going to give up revenue from timber, for example, because that would be the normal way that they would fund and finance their economic development to, you know, fund school fees and housing and healthcare and all of the sorts of things that we take for granted in, you know, developed economies. But also for farmers who might be farming on erosion prone lands, well, the thing they need to give up is revenue from farming. So if you can't fund those things, those opportunity costs, you're going to struggle to enable forest conservation to happen on, especially on private land. And so this is where and why I'm involved in carbon forestry.
Well, that's a really compelling story and one that will echo across the world. You know, we have these targets for tree planting, but what are people giving up and how is that going to be financed? So tell us, I thought this was a clever question, but you've just told me you've been asked this before. Forgive, this is a cheesy question alert. What is the ethos of ECOS?
Yeah, it's a good question. The word ecos comes from the ancient Greek word oikos, which is the common ancestor of the modern word economy and the modern word ecology. So they both have a common origin, and yet the modern economy has led them to be quite divergent. And ECOS is really a marriage of ecology and economics. So the ethos is to enable conservation and sustainable land management and looking after the place to work economically so that we can then do this at scale. If we want to make a good thing happen in a very small scale, like in our backyard or in one small area, then the economics don't really have to work. You know, people can rely on voluntary labour and goodwill and things like that. But if you need it to happen at scale, in other words, to change the course of history, which is what we need to do in a climate emergency like this.
Absolutely, we do. We're at such an important time in history, aren't we? We're at a tipping point.
Oh, absolutely. And the scale of the problem demands a scaled up solution. And in order to do things at scale, you've really got to get the economics to work. Because if you don't, you will only manage to do things at a relatively small level. So it's that scaling up which is key to us. And then that means financing. So that means capital, it means debt financing, a range of different financing arrangements, and getting into that, I guess, that big league of investment and financing. But we are committed to doing it in such a way that we don't kick the kindness out of the agenda. Because the purpose and the whole reason to do this is to look after the land and look after people. And so we're not going to compromise in terms of the ECOS approach to things. We're not going to compromise on that kindness element. So we kind of call it the kindness industry that we're involved in and compassionate financing.
That's wonderful. And I've got a real sense of that looking at your website as well and some of the images on there. But let's just go back to basics a little bit. I mean, companies or organizations, I note that one school is also involved with this, can have their, first of all, their carbon footprint measured. How do you do that in layman's terms, very simply?
Sure. A carbon footprint is the emissions, the carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions that come from a range of activities, most common of which is the burning of fossil fuels. So fossil carbon is, you know, biological carbon that's been stored under the earth for countless millions of years, and then we're taking it out of the ground and then we're combusting it. And when you burn it to release energy to drive vehicles and create electricity and things, the carbon that's stored in those oil or coal resources is then released to the atmosphere. And so you've got the long-term carbon cycle from fossil carbon now entering the short-term carbon cycle, in addition to all of the short-term carbon that's in the short-term carbon cycle. So you've got a new addition. Anyway, so that's the kind of background. But foreground for a company is that, or a school or whoever, a household, is to calculate how many fossil fuel emissions, for example, we're emitting. And so we don't run around with stethoscopes and nets to catch the carbon dioxide that comes out of a chimney. We can calculate that through knowing what the conversion factor is for when you combust a certain thing. So when oil or petrol is combusted, there is a conversion factor for that. When electricity is generated in one country, there is a conversion factor for that. In New Zealand, for example, our electricity is mostly from renewables, but we do have a small proportion of coal and fossil fuel electricity. So the emission factor for electricity to carbon dioxide emissions in New Zealand is different, say, to that in Australia, where the majority of their electricity is created through coal-fired power stations. And so there's quite a carbon-intensive electricity grid in Australia. In Europe, you've got a range of different possibilities. So basically, there are conversion factors for each activity, and we use those conversion factors to get an input like fuel consumed and then turn that into an emissions output. And then you do that across all of the activities that are relevant to that entity. So, for example, a typical school will consume electricity, there might be a boiler that does heating, there'll be refrigerants for fridges and freezers. There'll be vehicles that get to and from the school, things like this. Those are all part of what become the carbon footprint measurement exercise.
And so having worked out their carbon footprint, there are a number of options, but I guess, do you first of all think, show the organisation how they might reduce their carbon footprint?
Exactly. If I were to invite you to reduce your carbon footprint before you did any carbon footprint measurement, you really wouldn't know where to start. Or you might decide to do one thing, like change all your light bulbs to a more energy efficient light bulbs, but you might end up discovering that most of your emissions are actually from that single flight you did on holiday to south of France, which was orders of magnitude more costly to the atmosphere than all of your electricity consumption. So measuring the carbon footprint is a key part of the strategy for doing smart reductions, because what you do is identify the low-hanging fruit in your system where you can reduce your emissions at least cost, and sometimes at negative cost. So if you were to reduce your flights, you're also going to reduce the cost of that flying. And so that's a cost negative emission reduction. Then as you harvest that fruit, you'll end up having to turn to something else, which might be it might be changing your light bulbs, or it might be changing your patterns of getting to work, or it might be that you're telecommuting now instead of driving across town. These things are all going to impact on your emissions footprint. And so a reduction plan is really about identifying those low-hanging fruit and then deciding how high up the tree you're going to harvest these fruit, because anyone who's been an apple picker knows that the higher up the tree, the more effort per apple. And getting that last apple, the last apple is very expensive from the point of view of effort. And so carbon financing is about harvesting all your low-hanging fruit and your medium-hanging fruit for your reductions. But when those emission reductions start to get really expensive after you've harvested all of those easy wins, then you can think, okay, should I be harvesting those fruit on my own tree or buying carbon offsets? In other words, harvesting some low-hanging fruit on someone else's tree. And carbon markets are designed to drive our thinking into this efficiency sort of world, and strategically harvesting as many fruit as we can on our own tree, and then per unit effort and cost having a greater beneficial impact on the atmosphere by going and harvesting a whole lot of fruit, low-hanging fruit, on someone else's. That's essentially what offsetting is about.
That's so nicely explained, and a great example using a tree there as well. Thank you for that. Having made a decision there that they're not going to offset the high fruit because it's so intensive and expensive to do that, people can offset their carbon. And looking at your website, there are various different options available, such as 100% offset or 120, or a more sort of looser arrangement. Tell us how people can purchase these carbon offsetting credits and what happens with the credit? How is it transferred to something on the ground?
Sure. There are many different types of carbon credit. They are all representing 1 ton of carbon dioxide either taken out of the atmosphere or prevented from going into it. They need to be certified to international standards because we're trading something that we can't see. And so we need to wrap it up in so much red tape that we can see the red tape, but we can't see the carbon dioxide. So this is where standards are really important, and standards are the safeguards to enable the integrity of that offset to be maintained. There are many different activity types that will generate a carbon benefit to the atmosphere, and they can include somebody installing renewable energy systems instead of fossil fuel energy systems. They can include better management of emissions from agriculture, say. You can imagine a piggery that produces a lot of methane emissions could then change the way it manages that effluent so that it produces less methane emissions and thereby reduces its impact on the atmosphere. Forests are another place where you can produce carbon benefits, either from preventing forests from being deforested or reduced and degraded, because a forest is a reservoir of carbon. It's like a swimming pool full of carbon dioxide, because trees are made of carbon dioxide. About half of their dry weight is carbon atoms, which came from the air. And so they're like big storehouses of carbon. And if you remove a forest, that carbon is going to pretty quickly get into the atmosphere as emissions. So protecting existing forests is a wee bit like protecting an existing oil field, where we decide not to burn that oil, so we're leaving the oil in the reservoir. By protecting a forest, we're leaving the carbon in the forest and protect that reservoir. But of course, trees take in carbon from the air. That's how they're made. And so growing new forests is a way of taking carbon out of the air and storing it as wood through essentially the process of photosynthesis, where plants do this wonderful thing of getting the sun's energy and then using it to break water, the water molecule, and also to break the carbon dioxide molecule, and then rearranging those atoms to produce sugar. And a byproduct of that is oxygen, which plants then give out. But the sugar is the sap, which then feeds the tree to help drive its cellular energy systems, its cellular chemistry. But then it's also stored in the tree. So a very short sugar molecule is quite sweet to the taste. But if you make it longer, it gets less sweet. An example of a longer sugar molecule would be starch that you'd get in a potato or a carrot. And you know, carrots are quite sweet and potatoes less so. But then if you make it even longer again, you start to get wood. And they're not very sweet, but it's still sugar. And of course, when we consume sugar as humans, that sugar then drives our muscles. So where the energy stored in that sugar is released when we move our muscles. And that energy is actually the sun's energy that's been stored in that chemical bond. And so, in fact, every time we move, we're using the sun's energy, which is quite cool. But also when wood is combusted or when it degrades, that sun's energy is also consumed either in the fire or by the fungi and bacteria that are degrading it. And in each case, whether it's inside a human's body, driving our muscles, or inside a fungus or in burning, that process of releasing that energy gives us off CO2 as an emission. So the carbon that's stored in that sugar or wood is then released back to the atmosphere through the process of what we call respiration. And so what I find wonderful about this is that the process of photosynthesis and the process of respiration exist as an incredible kind of yin-yang at the heart of life and at the heart of the carbon cycle. And in fact, if you run the photosynthesis chemical equation in reverse, you get the chemical equation of respiration, which I think is very, very cool. So we turn this miraculous natural phenomenon into a business. And I find this just a wonderfully exciting place to work.
And so people can then buy credits to offset their carbon by protecting an indigenous woodland or planting an indigenous woodland. And I note you also work with landowners. You talk about, you know, what's in it for them, which is completely right. Hello, this is Tree Lady Talks, and I'm Sharon Durdant-Hollenby. All music and production is by Noel Durdant-Hollenby, and all views expressed by me or the interviewees are entirely personal. But also you have a scheme whereby there's carbon insetting, which is a more sustainable approach. Perhaps you could just say a little bit about that, please.
It's good to use the contrast between offsetting and insetting, because that's how they sort of are more meaningful as words. So offsetting means that you're harvesting low-hanging fruit on somebody else's tree. So you're causing a benefit to the atmosphere outside of your business boundary or outside of your organizational boundary. It's happening elsewhere, and somebody is therefore doing it on your behalf, but then selling that effort to you. And when you buy that carbon credit, you're paying for that effort to happen. So it's really important to note that carbon credits need to be additional. So they essentially need to pass an additionality test. Now, additional means it's not something that was just going to happen anyway. Yeah, it needs to be something that's been caused by that purchase of carbon credits, where the money that's spent by the buyer is then used to cause those good things to happen. Okay, so that's what offsetting is. You're paying somebody else to do some work to look after the planet on your behalf. Insetting is when you kind of, well, there's a range of different definitions for the word insetting, but the one that we use is where the benefit to the atmosphere is still happening inside your own organizational boundary or in some sort of joint venture. Now, if it's the creation of carbon credits that you want to then consume for your zero carbon or climate positive environmental declaration, it means that you're producing these carbon credits yourself in insetting. Imagine you already own some land where you could plant a forest on it and create carbon credits by passing that process, that forest through the due diligence of certification and create those carbon credits. But you own the land, so it's your own carbon credits, and then you're consuming them yourself. Mm-hmm. And when you consume carbon credits, you actually, mm-hmm, you have to cancel them in a carbon registry. So if I were to sell carbon credits to you, I can't make any claim against them because you own them now. And if you sell them to John, then John owns them and you can't make that claim. But if you were to receive those carbon credits and cancel them in the registry, right, that means they've gone to die. They've served their purpose. It's a wee bit like a rice commodity that's finally been eaten by somebody. You can't trade it anymore because it's been cancelled. And so that's the act of consuming carbon credits. And insetting is when you create your own supply chain of carbon credits. Offsetting is when that supply chain is on somebody else's land and you're essentially buying it off them. So if you're an entity that has a long-term view of the need to acquire carbon credits, imagine you've got a carbon footprint of, you know, 50,000 tonnes a year, and you're reducing it as much as you can, and even with a lot of effort and expense, you can reduce it down to 40,000 tonnes across maybe an eight-year period and in 30,000 tonnes after another 5 years. But you've still got that remaining residual footprint to take responsibility for if, in fact, you want to look after the planet. And so there's always, even for the next 20, 30 years, there's going to be a need for some kind of offsetting. But if you're in it for the long game, you think, maybe I should grow my own carbon credits. Because if you do that, then you can own that supply chain. It means you can own, it means you can control the provenance of those carbon credits. You can control the quality of them. You've got a security of supply because you're not competing in the market for carbon credits in any given year. And you can also insulate yourself to some extent, at least, from what the market carbon price might do. Because if the price is going to march northwards and possibly dramatically in the coming decades, and if you're tied to a commitment to acquire them, then that can become a very expensive thing. Whereas if you grow your own carbon credit supply, you can get them at cost. The difference being that you have to pay a lot more money at the beginning because you've got to build your carbon project. Whereas if you're buying offsets, it's just an operational expense. That's essentially what carbon insetting is.
Very interesting. So that might look like buying some land and planting a native woodland.
Or it could be partnering with a farmer who's saying to herself or himself, you know, I'd wish I could grow a forest on this land to maybe retire those paddocks because the land is erosion prone and it's not really that profitable for me as a farmer, and nature's always trying to reclaim that land. So maybe I should become a carbon farmer on that land. And maybe I could partner with a company that wants to fund that reforestation, because I might be asset rich but cash poor, and it's true for many farmers. And maybe I don't have the cash to capitalise the establishing of that forest. And then I partner with somebody who might want to be the one who provides that cash capital to establish that forest and look after it on my land. And then we just split a percentage of the carbon credit. So I then have some as a farmer, and then I can sell them on the market. And the insetting partner consumes, you know, they get their share as per an agreement that we strike up between us. So buying land and doing it that way, that's one approach. Partnering with people is another approach to carbon insetting.
So you're really solving socio-economic problems as well as biodiversity issues as well as carbon credits. So it's quite a multifaceted benefit. It's like a holistic win-win.
That's the goal.
And people can buy, you know, just buy a credit if they've taken a long flight, or they can buy gift cards, etc., with carbon credits. So it's really from the macro scale to the sort of fantastic original birthday present scale. So that's really, really innovative. What are the key drivers of change currently in New Zealand for mitigating climate change?
The key driver is that both political parties in New Zealand, there's a bipartisan agreement in our government that we would join the Paris Agreement and meet those commitments. The key drivers that are happening now is the rising price of carbon, and there's just been an auction last week which set a new price. And there's a recognition that looking around the world at Europe, and the price of carbon is higher in those markets. So the other key driver is really the government in its initial stages has decided to protect certain industries, partially farming and transport and a few others. And so it's a matter, the key driver is how people have to react when government starts to initiate plans of removing that protection.
And certainly in the New Zealand setting, he's described the compliance carbon market, where people who are buying carbon, they have to buy because the government has told them that they have to buy carbon credits. So they have a regulatory obligation. But the carbon market on the demand side, it's a wee bit like rugby. You can imagine the difference between rugby union and rugby league. To an untrained eye, they look like the same game, but actually...
I must say, to me, they do look like men falling over.
That's right.
Or women falling over.
That's right. It looks like the same game, but of course, those who are involved in these sports know they're very different. And so the compliance carbon market, imagine that's like rugby union. The voluntary carbon market would be maybe like rugby league. So it's got the same shape ball, so it still trades carbon credits, but there's different drivers of supply and demand. So in the voluntary carbon market, unlike the compliance carbon market, the buyers are all voluntary, where there's no regulatory obligation to buy. Companies and individuals and organizations who say to themselves, yeah, I want to be part of the global solution, and so I'm going to voluntarily measure my carbon footprint, reduce my carbon footprint, and I'm going to then take responsibility for the remaining emissions and go the extra distance and buy carbon offsets to look after the place even more than just reducing as much as I can. So this is the voluntary carbon market buyer. It's corporate social responsibility, social good, social purpose businesses, and people wanting to do the right thing. So it's quite a different buyer to the compliance market. And the voluntary buyer community is a rapidly growing sector that has entered the carbon market globally and also in New Zealand. And what they are doing is adding to demand for carbon credit production in this country. The interesting thing about the voluntary buyers is because they're coming to this activity voluntarily, they're typically more interested in a feel-good story than just going after the cheapest units that they can get. Whereas the compliance buyer, not always, but many of the compliance buyers are compelled by their governing boards to acquire the lowest cost credits that they can get. Whereas the voluntary buyer often have a greater appetite for paying price premiums to get a better quality carbon credit at the end of the process. So carbon credits, as I mentioned before, are like there are many different activities that will produce them. And even in the forest space, there's many different types of forest projects that can produce carbon credits. So a little bit like, it's kind of like either whiskey, where you've got top shelf single malt whiskey, which is more expensive than, you know, mid-range bottom shelf whiskey. It's still got the same alcohol content, but there's reasons why people buy top shelf single malt. It's also like coffee. You've got single origin coffee and you've got blended coffee. And at one end of that market, you've got fair trade coffee. And at the other end of the market, you've got blended cheap as you can get. Who cares about the supply chain? Now, carbon is like that. At one end of in the voluntary market especially, and at one end of the spectrum is the least cost carbon credits that might have very few co-benefits in them. So there's an atmospheric benefit, but there might not be many social benefits or biodiversity benefits. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got carbon credits that have got orangutans in them, where you are helping to save a rainforest and biodiversity conservation in a global biodiversity hotspot, and where that project might be paying a lot of attention to community well-being and jobs and employment and fair wages and all these kinds of things. So you can imagine that fair trade carbon at one end, multiple co-benefits, delivering on several sustainable development goals, and at the other end, you're kind of commodity carbon. And the voluntary buyer is much more interested in the high co-benefit carbon, and that's why ECOS works predominantly, well, in fact, at the moment, only in that space of supplying voluntary buyers, because we want to work with people who want to look after the planet, and we want to help farmers and landowners who can only afford to give up the right to agriculture or give up the right to logging on their land if they can be adequately compensated for that. And that type of carbon is more expensive than the commodity carbon.
So several things come out of that. One is, it strikes me as a voluntary buyer that there is so much to be gained from their own PR. You know, they can tell the story of how they are helping not only with their carbon offsetting, but really perhaps enabling a community to have a good standard of living, helping biodiversity by protection or appropriate planting or management. And that really becomes part of their own brand. And so I rather hope that has a ripple effect. But the other thing that came out of that for me was, can compulsory carbon offsetting at its cheapest level cause harm in other things, like such as biodiversity, for example, can it lead to quick, easy carbon crops, which you lose the great sort of sensitivity of the ecosystem that was there already in the name of saving the planet?
It's a very good point, Sharon. And there's a fundamental trade-off in carbon pricing. If you raise the number of co-benefits that you deliver in your project, those projects are going to be more costly to develop. So the break-even price for those carbon credits goes up because there might be more biodiversity in there. You might be planting a much wider range of species that are not the cheapest trees to plant. They're more expensive to plant because they're native trees, and then you've got a diversity of them. So the price goes up. Your forest that you're planting might produce carbon credits at a slower rate than industrial plantations. And so you've got higher costs at one end and slower production rates at the other. When you combine those things, it challenges the economics, and you can only kind of solve that problem by raising prices so that you can actually cover all of your costs. So that carbon is more expensive when it's got more co-benefits. And I guess in compliance carbon trading, there can be a drive for the cheapest carbon credits in order to satisfy this demand at scale. And as you've signaled, and it does and can happen, is where there can be unintended consequences that are not so beneficial. And in fact, in New Zealand, there's an emerging controversy around the conversion of whole farms to carbon forestry. And whilst it might be good for the atmosphere, local communities are increasingly unhappy about this, because what happens in industrial forestry compared to agriculture is the number of jobs per geographic region tend to go down, especially in that period of, say, 30 years between planting and harvesting that forest. And so that can have a negative impact on those communities, where the voluntary fire service loses its volunteers, where the school loses its population and closes down, where communities get smaller and smaller and struggle more and more. So that's one example of a negative consequence. Other examples of very large scale carbon forestry can be less attention to the needs of local and indigenous peoples. And there's been over the last decade and more, a lot of criticism and justifiable criticism of the way international carbon projects in some parts of the world have actually caused social hardship in developing countries, alienation of land, and negative impacts on indigenous peoples and forest dwelling communities. And this is also where standards become really important. If you've got a standard which has a rule that says, well, you can't do all those negative things, then the only way to create your carbon credit is to not cause those negative impacts. And in the voluntary carbon market, you've got standards which have safeguards in them to deliver exactly what I've described, to deliver the prevention of those negative consequences. In fact, the standard that we use is what we regard as the world's leading fair trade styled carbon standard, which is the Plan Vivo standard, who has a very strong opinion on whether there are community co-benefits or not. And if they're not there, then they won't certify. And they also require you to have biodiversity co-benefits, and if they're not there, they won't certify. When it comes to compliance carbon, I think governments need to think about the potential need for safeguards to prevent perverse outcomes from happening. Because even if the ultimate goal is to meet our Paris Agreement obligation and to produce lots of carbon in the rural landscape, if you create a political backlash by upsetting many rural communities, then you put the whole carbon market at risk. And so I think that there's a very strong need for, I believe, additional safeguards. In fact, we've written submissions along these lines to the New Zealand government in recent times on exactly this point.
And there are two other effects that Sean hasn't touched on, with the New Zealand public looking at what their options are, and that is in that rural community, that looking at farming versus a complete farm being planted, and we had that happen 25 years ago when the first schemes took off and are now being harvested, but the prospect of that land being planted and left is really creating some unknowns that, you know, won't even create the workforce when it's harvested. On the other hand, New Zealanders are very pragmatic people, And a lot of things happened to investment choices after the share market crash of 87. And those people, of course, are still active and are the most wealthy in the country. And so the prospect of doing something where you can see it yourself and you can control it yourself, in other words, property investment versus share, and you know, where someone else is in control of the price of that commodity, is very real. And then the other thing was, there was a period, and Sean knows this better than me, where you could offset by buying credits from another country, and those very quickly sort of seemed to have a negative connotation because there was a lot of junk credits that came out of Eastern Bloc countries, I understand. And once again, that was, well, you thought you were saving the planet and you probably weren't. And there was no action being taken in New Zealand.
Just as a more general philosophical point, you know, where we're trying to do something good, if it's not thought out properly, there are unintended consequences. And sometimes there's a problem if we just focus on one thing, because as the work you're doing in ECOS, you know that everything is interconnected, every aspect of it, including people's well-being. And it's the same perhaps where there's a lot of attention on single species. If we talk about ecology that is being protected, of course, it's very important to protect that single species. And it's often an indication of the health of the wider ecosystem. Sometimes it can be so blinkered that there are other unintended consequences which are harmful. So actually, yes, of course, the Paris Agreement is great. I'm not going to argue with that, but I do say, you know, people need to be reminded of the complexity of our planet and that it's not a single bullet, because human nature is such that we just want a quick solution. Oh, good, oh, I can save the planet and buy that. But wow, I'm so pleased that you're working so hard on that. And what issues are the government in New Zealand and industry focused on?
I guess a response around the government's thinking at the moment to try and maximise, or thinking of trying to maximise the spread of benefits that come out of carbon forestry. The New Zealand Climate Change Commission has just released recently a discussion document and is seeking public consultation on how to manage the way in which we do carbon forestry in a way that delivers a broader range of benefits. Climate change is not just about reducing emissions. It's also about building resilient landscapes that can cope with an increasing number of extreme weather events that include ex-tropical cyclones that are going to cause a lot of flooding and flood damage and send an awful lot of sediment into streams and damage infrastructure like roads and bridges and these sorts of things. Now, in economic terms, we could describe the climate change risk as a contingent liability risk on infrastructure. So a future risk of cost on infrastructure like roads and bridges and property in the face of these more extreme weather events that are coming. So our landscapes, for example, are in the boxing ring, and they're used to boxing with a welterweight, but the storms that are going to start coming are going to be heavyweights. And unless we're prepared for that, our landscapes won't be able to cope with this. So there's a very strong need for climate resilience. Building a climate resilient landscape includes, for example, getting erosion prone lands and rehabilitating them. And many of these erosion-prone lands are agricultural lands, pastoral farming, on land that is too steep really to sustain farming properly. In fact, it's only profitable to farm on those lands if you externalize a lot of costs onto other people. For example, all the sediment that gets exported downstream and damages the water quality and damages the inshore marine environment. It also damages downstream property. If you had to price the cost of that damage back onto the farm, it wouldn't be profitable. We need to rehabilitate many of these landscapes, and we've got a great opportunity, I believe, and ECOS believes, in harnessing the energy of entrepreneurs and the innovation of the carbon markets to not only reduce our emissions and pull carbon out of the air, but also at the same time to do it in a way that creates climate resilient landscapes, so permanent native forests to cover those erosion prone lands, but where, because the farmer needs to give up the revenue from agriculture in order to become a carbon forester, to enable them to be a carbon farmer on those paddocks that really should be retired. And ideally even become a more profitable farm when they are doing higher quality farming on higher quality land further down slope, and then doing carbon forestry further up slope. There's a fantastic opportunity in New Zealand and in many countries around the world to harness carbon markets for those ends.
John, did you have something to add to that question?
Well, the other thing I was just going to add to what Sean said is that in New Zealand, people often are very pragmatic, as I mentioned. And so they, where they can see an example of something, they say, okay, I can acknowledge that. And exactly what Sean talked about, climate resilient landscapes in the on the East Cape, which is a very rugged coastal line of New Zealand. And of course, it was famous as the first place to see the sun in 2000. But it's also well known because in the 80s, we had severe storms that just tore the landscape apart. And of course, the foresters were pleased to take pictures of radiata pine slopes right next to completely eroded farming paddocks. But what we did is we planted it. And even at the time it was being planted in pine, we were all looking at each other going, how are we going to actually harvest that? And when we did harvest it, as Sean said, the rain events were bigger. And all of a sudden, the forestry social license came under attack when the post-harvest debris was going down onto to ruined farms and the coastline. And so we've had to create some new standards to avoid that practice. And then it had been a lift in practice. So when it comes to the compliance market, New Zealanders can see the effects, because you mentioned the East Coast and everyone's got a view of what's the right solution. But we've also been through an exercise of, well, we probably back in the 80s, we should have planted native forest there, but we didn't have a mechanism for paying people to do that. We do have a thing called the QE Trust, but it's actually the cost of that comes from the farmer wanting to do the extra things that Sean talks about.
And so is there a move towards continual cover forestry?
Yes. But at the time in the 80s, I don't think it was really thought of as practical. We had a fleeting idea that kauri forestry would save us all, but it really didn't get off the ground. And once again, they weren't talking about a mix of native species for the right land and slope and soil class. It was we were trying to turn kauri forestry into a production tree.
New Zealand has had a polarized mind when it comes to conservation and forestry production, where conservation has tended to mean pure native forests and no harvesting of timber, and production forestry has tended to mean monoculture plantations with minimal biodiversity benefit and a range of other challenges. And that those two extremes have not really served, well, I don't think they're going to serve the country into the future. And I think the government is acknowledging that. ECOS, our role is to be a middle path between extremes. And a continuous canopy production forestry is very much part of, I believe, the future of forestry in New Zealand, where as we transition from not in all parts of the landscape, but certainly in more sensitive parts of the landscape, continuous cover forestry, which is more like the forestry that's done in Europe and in the UK, where you've got, you're not clear cutting massive areas and whole catchments. You are always maintaining forest cover in a catchment, and you're doing a much more, nuanced form of forestry production. And with multiple species and for multiple benefit. And this is a great opportunity to use carbon financing to make that continuous canopy forestry more profitable so that it can compete with large-scale plantations. And it gives the opportunity to some local government entities to say, okay, on these high erosion-prone landscapes, we are not going to allow clear-cut forestry to happen anymore. We will allow production forestry. In fact, we encourage it, but it needs to be continuous canopy. Before a local government can do that, though, the forest industry needs to prove that it can actually do this kind of management. And so I think right now is a really important stage in forest history in New Zealand to demonstrate and continuous canopy forestry, to learn from the experience of continuous canopy forestry in Europe and Britain, and then to create a new future for these marginal lands that desperately need an income You know, people still need to make a living on their private land.
Of course.
And so this is a chance to have multi-use forestry on private land, which is currently erosion-prone grass that's got very few co-benefits to nature and a lot of negatives, and turn that into a multi-use, multi-purpose, multi-benefit form of forestry, which is better than the baseline situation, the existing erosion-prone grass. It might not be as good as pure native forests, but you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And in a climate emergency, we have to do good things. We can't afford to just demand that they're all going to be perfect.
Just going slightly off topic, really briefly, talking about future forestry in New Zealand, have you got enough people coming into the industry?
Oh, I think that all the trades are much more popular in the last few years, even though a lot of people have wanted, even tradespeople have wanted their children to go to university because it's seen as a safe career path. The mechanization has taken place in the industry, and that was of harvesting, and now we're taking on the Scandinavian. There's just the start of mechanized tree planting. So probably the numbers of low-wage labor jobs are slowly disappearing. And there's also technology. I mean, part of our effect of running conferences is that when we try and bring young people into our conferences regularly now, and when their own traditional view of forestry is either a man cutting a tree with a chainsaw or someone driving a log truck to a port, which has been real in the past, we're starting to get people who are realizing that there's some very rewarding technology jobs, and more women has been strongly promoted. So it's all headed in the right direction, and there's certainly not a lack of awareness.
On the subsector of the industry that we work in, the economics of conservation carbon forestry are challenging, which is one of the reasons why there's not a rapidly growing industry at scale in this subsector. But it is growing gradually, and our aspiration is to grow it more by getting the economics to work and demonstrate it and get investment into the space. But at the moment, there isn't a large demand for jobs in this space, partly because it's not operating at the scale it could do. But as soon as it starts to operate at scale, as soon as we start to get into continuous canopy forestry, and as soon as larger scale carbon forestry starts to happen at scale, it's going to need a lot of people. So you think about the Hawke's Bay in New Zealand, which suffered from massive erosion in the 1980s and needs to still be reforested. The regional government there wants to reforest 300,000 hectares. Of that land into permanent native forest. Now, you're going to need a lot of people to go plant.
Yeah.
So as we move to scale in the conservation forestry, there is going to be a large demand, A, for labour, B, for managers, C, for innovators, and D, for foresters and silviculturalists. So I can see an upsurge in demand for jobs, and I think the universities are going to respond by providing those people. But I think the industry needs to demonstrate the jobs are there first.
Also, you need to have the trees to plant in the first place as well, don't you? Is there great nursery production in New Zealand?
I don't think that's a bottleneck in the system quite yet. The bottleneck is really the labour, if you want to scale up really rapidly. Even though there's a lot of people who are unemployed and you want to offer jobs to those people, people don't immediately get off and get into a workspace. There's got to be a plan in a region to enable that. So there's, you know, labour market challenges that need to be overcome in this space as well.
So in terms of native forestry, right outside our office here is the most automated native forestry nursery, and it's connected to one in the Minganui, and it's a joint government and Indigenous people initiative, and they're actually well and truly on the path to making sure there's no bottleneck in native forestry. And looking outside, we talk to our forestry neighbors, our nursery neighbors all the time, and they're about to put up a second greenhouse. They're just massive greenhouses that are going up for making sure we've got the native plants. And as Sean said, the need for labor is that mechanized planting is only for exotic species. There's no move, you know, it's quite a challenge to plant native lands that are also steep. So that's something that we still have to look at.
Where does forestry fit into the carbon mitigation plan?
As Sean said, the Climate Commission has put out consultation that finishes later this month, but I think there will be quite an engaging debate, and I think that it'll be a difficulty keeping it the time frames, because there's so much diverse opinion around this, because there's a you know, Sean's clearly in a market where the voluntary market prefers native, it prefers the wider benefits, and it's seen as a slow start mitigation solution, but a long-term one with many gains, longer-term gains and wider gains. And traditionally, what's more visible to your average person in the rural landscape is, as soon as you drive around rural New Zealand, you see the farms on the flats, and as soon as that land gets to 40 to 100% slope, it tended to be radiata pine. And so you've got this playoff, and even if you look at a person who's a registered forester in New Zealand, in order for them to give professional advice, they have to actually tell people, you know, these are the differences, and you know it's a much longer game, it's a slower carbon sequestration process, and often when people look at it, you know, and they're probably dealing with really the compliance end of the market and people who just want to see what they need to do to satisfy carbon sequestration that their organization needs, they're duty bound to say, well, you know, single species and 25 gets you 25 years of carbon mitigation. And the other thing is, the Climate Change Commission has come right out at the start and said, we can't plant our way out of this crisis. In other words, they want to see real reductions in New Zealand. And really, when I look at that, I think if the world's going to start buying electric and hydrogen cars, we're going to be a long way from that market. And we're going to be the smallest people, we're going to be the last served. So it's hard to see pure reduction. The biggest one we can see is hydrogen trucks, because we can produce hydrogen, green hydrogen here reasonably. You know, they can see how they can do it. But yeah, in terms of planting trees versus electric cars, I think people would see planting any kind of tree ahead of paying a premium of 50% for an electric car that they don't even know if that battery is going to be sustainably recycled.
The work that we do is, when I describe ECOS as a middle path player, part of that middle path is not just to plant native only species. So they grow very slowly and the economics are very challenging. As soon as you introduce some exotics to your planting, when the purpose is native forestry and it's pure natives in the long term, but it doesn't have to be pure native at the beginning.
And I get that. So you're using them as what we call them a nurse. Do you call them a nurse crop?
Yeah. So you can plant natives with exotics. If you introduce exotics to the planting plan, it doesn't mean to say that there are exotics and natives growing in every hectare, but you might just put an exotic woodlot in as part of the project. And then as soon as you do that, you're lifting the economics for the whole project so that the natives can actually get started. And so what we do in our model is we've got three reasons for using exotics. One is to fund the natives. The second one is to fund the natives. And the third one is to fund the natives, is to make the economics work. And if you then manage the exotic portion as continuous canopy forestry with adaptive management, then as you manage that forest through time, you can end up replacing an exotic with an exotic or an exotic with a native. And this is the great middle path opportunity, where there is an industry waiting to happen in this space, and ECOS is trying to create the demonstration activities to prove it. And at the moment, we've already been planting many, many hectares of land in exactly this way, and where the forestry management plans are explicitly involving the transition of the exotics to a native forest in the long term. But where in any given site, you don't know how long it's going to take for the natives to grow well and become dominant. So you've got to have an adaptive strategy to enable that to take as long as it needs, and then plant as many natives as you can. And as the carbon price keeps rising through time, your ability to reduce the area of exotics that you have in your overall project, you can have less and less exotics involved, because the higher the carbon price, the more economically viable the native forestry component is. So this is the real exciting space of having cakes and eating them.
Why do you think people are drawn to forestry in New Zealand rather than other carbon mitigation options?
I think people who see the need, and farmers are feeling under pressure. They the farmers are a little bit upset that the Paris Agreement has set certain ways to measure carbon, and soil carbon hasn't been one of them. But people who are drawn to practical solutions, and especially when a farmer feels the pressure of government, and they've already done set aside a native area and a QET trust, they feel like they've done the right thing for the environment, but there's no compensation under the carbon. And the other thing is very much the investment story is that if you look back 30 years ago, I was advising farmers who said, what is this radiata pine? And if you were a sheep farmer 30 years ago, and remember, we've lost a lot of sheep in that time, people who planted trees on their farm were considered failed farmers in the traditional sheep farming community. But when they harvested those forests, they received such a massive, they were generating $70,000 a hectare, which was unheard of at the time of planting. All of a sudden, people could see that those failed farmers were actually future foresters. On one end of the scale, that's why people have been drawn to it. And you see so much of it in the landscape. We don't have many motorways in New Zealand. Your roads going from community to community and region to region, you wind your way around the hills and see the forestry on them. That's my view of why in the compliance market, why people have been drawn to forestry.
At the moment, if you're a voluntary buyer of carbon, or even if you're a compliance buyer of carbon in New Zealand, well, especially if you're a compliance buyer, you're not allowed to buy any other type of carbon credit. There isn't any other type. You've only got New Zealand units, essentially, from forestry. So that there's, unless the government opens up international carbon again, in which case there may be other activity types that they could support. So compliance buyers have to buy forest carbon. So there's nothing else. There's a possibility that the government might open up other activities for carbon trading, and that's part of its kind of review process at the moment. That could include soil carbon, it could include blue carbon, you know, marine carbon, could include any number of things. But in order for any of these other activities to realistically contribute, there needs to be a whole lot of development and science to enable that to become a readily available instrument. Now, forests are much simpler things to measure, and they're much simpler things to attribute the change in carbon stocks to somebody's action. Whereas if you've got soil carbon, it's more difficult to measure and more expensive to measure. And then you've got to attribute the carbon stock change in the soil to a management intervention that somebody caused. And these things are much more tricky, which is why soil carbon and other carbon activities are, in theory, yes, they can be done, but in practice, they've got to work in such a way that it's very simple enough to regulate, and it's simple enough to use. And this is one of the right reasons why forestry is so strong. In the voluntary carbon market, though, voluntary buyers can acquire their carbon credits from many different activity types, especially if they source their credits internationally, and they can include international energy sector activities at the big industrial scale, or international energy sector activities at the community scale. Think of cook stove projects in Africa that are helping communities avoid having to cut trees down to do their cooking. These are carbon credit projects, and people can buy those credits and support those communities. Our buyers tend to focus, in terms of ECOS buyers, we funnel them into the forest space, even internationally, into places where communities need reforestation or forest protection. But there are a range of different activity types available to the voluntary buyer, which is a contrast to the compliance sector.
Is there a consensus amongst government and the major emitters on where mitigation efforts should be focused?
I'm not so sure that there is consensus on strategy. There might be a consensus scientifically on the need for fossil fuel reductions, but there is an absence, in my view, of a coherent strategy for reduction. And I think this is what's lagging behind a lot in a country like New Zealand. Our transportation emissions are going up and up. Our investment in roading infrastructure is going up and up. The things that are actually strategically happening on the ground seem to run in contrast to what would be a strategy for deep reductions in emissions. And I think there's a range of possible reasons for this, but I think arguments that aren't sufficiently economically thought through end up causing more problems than solutions. And so I think a country like New Zealand and any country in the world needs to have a really close look at the economics of these reductions and see how they strategically align with a future world that you want to create. In a country where a lot of electricity is generated through coal, well, what is the future for that country if it stays with coal? What is its future for international trade for commodities that come out of that country? These are the bigger issues, I think, that really haven't been wrestled with enough at the national policy level. And as a result, there's an element of tinkering around the edges and not really naming the elephant in the room.
Interesting. And John, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think the government wants to see a holistic reduction, which is, let's reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And New Zealanders, all of us are addicted to the fossil fuel burning four-wheel motor vehicle. And I did a short survey on the weekend, which is we're also addicted to utes and SUVs because we're such a rural landscape. And it's really hard to wean people off that. In terms of the major emitters, people who are in the compliance market, the other history we have is that most of our forests were sold to pension funds through the TIMO market. And there's a very comfortable relationship with the investing in New Zealand using international funds and they've got very comfortable with production forestry in New Zealand and the major emitters. And, there's a high, strong level of comfort about you can also do carbon forestry if you're a major emitter. So the practical history is that all the things that need to happen aren't solved by planting carbon forestry. And I do think the government said they think that the cost to the GDP is very low. I'm not sure that the average person in the street believes them.
Moving on to a really exciting conference that's happening in June. Could you tell us what the conference is about?
Well, with the changes that the Carbon Commission was set up to advise the government independently what action needed to be taken. So their consultation has gone out publicly and they've told the government that the cost is relatively low in GDP terms and it's put a whole lot of options out there for government to be transparent about how it considers them. So it's going to start a public debate, which is needed. And our role is that every time this happens, it does involve forestry. So by necessity, we want to get the investors and the foresters together. And quite simply, the time was right to create a debate around. And as Sean says, there's quite a bit of need to promote the voluntary market and the mix of solutions that are there, because it's no good having a polarized debate about I want native and I want all the benefits, or look, I can just plant 50,000 hectares of radiata and I'm fine. It's about finding, because we've got the professionals in the room, it's about debating where the solutions are right for who. And we've got a very strong following on LinkedIn. We're just about 1,000 followers, which has come from nothing in the last 6 to 8 weeks. So as well as having we'll probably have 150 to 200 people in the room in New Zealand. But one of the effects of COVID that we didn't really anticipate, which is a good one, was normally we run 12 conferences a year. We ran two last year, two real conferences. We got zoomed out and so did everyone else by the virtual ones that we already had planned. But what we found with we run Forest Tech, which is very much the forest management inventory, and all that technology is just taking off and leaps and bounds. So we normally run that in Melbourne, Vancouver and Rotorua, but it actually, we only could run it in Rotorua. So we had 180 people in the room last year, but we had 180 people from 20 countries online virtually attending that conference, because the technology is all global. You can have a Swedish firm cooperating with a Canadian firm and they're measuring carbon all around the world. So that planet system for measuring changes in your forest landscape, that technology is global as well as local. So you can collect the data globally, but you have to locally measure it using a professional forester who knows that landscape. So we are expecting, very much like Forestech, we're expecting as big a virtual audience as we do have, just because of the interest in New Zealand from a mix of carbon forestry and production forestry and native. And I think it's about making people much more aware of what the options are from the professionals who we've got speaking. So we've got Dr. Rod Carr, who's the chair of the Climate Commission. And of course, his discussion is we can't plant our way out of this.
Where can people find out about the conference and how can they book?
They can go to carbonforestry.events. And all the information is there for virtually attending. And we're already a third of the way to filling up the room. So there's already strong interest and our promotions are only starting next week. There's a very easy virtual platform and people who register for the virtual conference, even though we'll be out of sync with a number of time zones, they will, of course, be able to go through the library of presentations and watch it at their convenience.
So we're going to put a link on our website. So listeners, go to our website, Sharon Hosegood Associates. Look at the page for this particular episode and you can see a link to the course there. Finally, Sean, what's your dream scenario?
My dream scenario is where looking after the place is embedded in every supply chain in the world economy. There's not enough money in the public purse to solve the world's problems, and especially not the world's climate problems. But there is enough money in the global economy to do this and in the private sector. And carbon markets have demonstrated that you can embed looking after the place in the voluntary carbon market, where you can embed looking after the place in a value chain, where a company offers a service or a product and they say on it, look, this is zero carbon. And those products and those services are competing very well in the market. And they're creating a new economy where more and more suppliers of goods and services are decarbonizing before they offer that service. And so imagine somebody who really doesn't want to help the climate system. That maybe they're really completely opposed to it. But one day, everything they buy and everything they do will be decarbonized before it gets to them. To me, that's the future. And looking after the carbon parts of the world is not the whole story. So when our carbon solutions also come with lots and lots of co-benefits, where we source our carbon credits from projects that help deliver climate resilience, help deliver biodiversity and water quality and community development, then we're starting to transform the way in which we do things. When we source our carbon credits, say from international sources, we target the Pacific Islands. And then in the process, we help to deliver sustainable development goal outcomes in our region without it having to come out of the taxpayer's pocket. And this really changes the whole game. So that's the future for me, is the embedding of looking after the planet into every supply chain.
Yes, so it just becomes a natural thing rather than something that has to be programmed.
That's right. And it also means you're not having to ask everybody in the economy to change their outlook on life, their values or their concern. That you're not asking that to happen. You are just changing what is available when they go to buy something. And I think this relates to what is our theory of change. Do we think that the way to change the world is to airbrush everybody into adopting a particular outlook and value set? I don't think that's going to work. It hasn't worked so far. I don't think it'll work at the kind of scale we need it. Whereas if somebody turns up to a car yard and says, oh, look, they're only electric, and if they find that they don't really need a car very much because the public transport system is so good that cars are not needed, or where instead of owning cars, you just do Spotify for cars, where you buy access to cars rather than own them. And then when you need one, you just, you know, go on your phone app and find a rideshare vehicle that's parked around the corner, and then you book it for the weekend and off you go. You know, this is the future where the actual supply chain itself is changed, so that we don't need to rely on trying to change people's values or culture. I think it's so important to respect people's values and respect people's culture, and then they're going to be a lot less threatened by the change that comes. So that's the future for me.
John, do you have a dream scenario?
Yes. I mean, I was a Boy Scout when I was young, and I feel like I am reasonably responsible at understanding things that affect myself and my family, and trying to learn about what the positive and negative effects are them. So my dream scenario is that everyone takes a bit more personal responsibility. And I think in society, there's a lot of people who will be rethinking that, since they just don't hop on a plane and go around the globe for their holiday. But there are a lot of people who can't afford to make those choices because they just have enough money and sometimes not enough to get through the week. I read a book about 20 years ago, which talked about social capital, financial capital, and human capital. And the environment was embedded in that book. But when I tried to socialize that around my community, people looked at me weird when I talked about social capital. And of course, now we see social capitals replacing GDP as one of the capitals that we need to plan for. So I guess things happen over 20 years. So my dream scenario is that people take responsibility for their actions and make informed decisions. That's easier depending on where you sit in the realm of the society to do that. But the thing that gives me hope that it's happened is we try to have a bit of diversity in our conferences. So 3-4 years ago, I started running Protein Tech to invite, you know, the technology around alternate proteins was taking off. And of course, Singapore is now the international hub for this. And when we first started it, we had to work with the sheep and beef people here to say, well, you know, we're not saying that's going to go, because of course New Zealand can only feed 40 million people. So they're always going to feed the 40 million who can afford our grass-fed beef and sheep, beef and lamb. But in the space of the 3 years that since we started running Protein Tech, you can buy a plant burger at all the major food outlets that, you know, commodity food buyers buy their food. And that change, that underpins what Sean's saying, is it'll end up implicit in the system, and the big carbon emitters will want to do the right thing. So I look at the way plant proteins have taken off, and some people would sit down and eat a burger not even knowing that it's plant-based. So I think it's already happened in that space. And from that point of view, everyone will be an environmental Boy Scout in my dream scenario.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you both so much. It's John Stullen and Sean Weaver. Loved it.
Thanks,
thank you. Thank you.
Hit the subscribe button to guarantee you don't miss an episode, and you can follow us on
Twitter at TheTreeLady67,
Instagram TreeLady Talks,
Facebook Sharon Hosegood Associates,
or send an email to noel@treeladytalks.co.uk. Okay, so in common up-to-date parlance, what's your takeaway from that?
There's so much more to it than popping along to the virtual shop and buying a bit of carbon credits. It's really got to think about the impact of that and how much good you could do to the environment, to people, as well as purchasing carbon offsetting credits. It's an opportunity to really spread the love, man. We've got loads coming up. We're going to do a Women in a Borough Culture special with lots of different interviews, dropping into a busy coffee morning. And we're going to be speaking to Nev Fay. He's a great philosopher and thinker of all things trees and soil and the natural world.
Okay, so that wraps up today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe with all the usual stuff. And it's goodbye from me then.
And it's goodbye from him. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, haven't had the triangle for a while, Noel.
Have now.